I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. This has been a year of intense and dangerous weather, and 2016 isn't over yet. Residents in Louisiana have been grappling with floods from torrential rains that left 13 dead and forced thousands from their homes. West Virginia had the worst floods in 100 years earlier this summer. California has been dealing with a multi-year drought, and now there are fires fueled by the parched land and high temperatures. One day in June, the temperature in Yuma, Arizona was 120, 118 in Phoenix, and 115 in Tucson. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration reported that global temperatures for 2015 were the highest on record, and NASA announced that last month, July, was the hottest month ever recorded. It sure was hot here in the Philadelphia area. This raises several questions. Are these weather events a sign of climate change, and what is the link between intense weather and the warming planet? We have two guests who have joined us, including Heidi Cullen. She's with us here in our Philadelphia studio, chief scientist at Climate Central. She leads the World Weather Attribution Program, also serves as the chief science advisor for the Years of Living Dangerously Project, and is the author of The Weather of the Future. Heidi Cullen, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
Also with us and joining us by ISDN is David Titley. He's a professor of meteorology at Penn State University and the founding director of their Center for Solutions to Weather and Climate Risk. He's a retired Rear Admiral, led the U.S. Navy's Task Force on Climate Change. And David Titley, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks very much, Marty.
You're welcome. And Heidi, let me begin with you. Let's begin with July, the hottest month ever recorded, not just here in the Philadelphia area, but around the world. Sustained heat, days of extreme record-breaking heat. What does July tell us?
Yeah, so basically the numbers came in for July, and what we found was that it was the 15th consecutive record hot month. And really, I think what it shows us is that this is not the behavior of a natural climate system, right? But here we're looking at global averages, and I think what we're seeing play out is that a lot of the damage really occurs in the extremes, right? You've got average global surface temperature that's high. 2016 is pretty much on track to set the next record for the warmest year. But it's the extremes where I think we really see the damage play out.
And the extremes meaning those days when it gets to be 112
degrees
or something.
Exactly. Those heat waves, the drought, the kinds of events that we saw recently play out in places like Baltimore and Louisiana.
Let me turn to you, David Titley, and what we're looking to is to connect the dots. Looking at the temperatures in July, can we say that's from global warming, from climate change?
So thanks for the question.
Sure.
One of the things you see in that Heidi mentioned, I think, is really, really important, is not so much that July was the hottest ever recorded, but it was the 15th consecutive, I think, year that we keep seeing these. And climate is really this integration across space and across time. So you certainly can have in weather, and of course the records go back, you can have individual extreme events. But what to me is so striking is that we keep setting these records, be it, you know, incredibly warm Decembers. If you remember, people were having picnics.
I do.
On Christmas Day.
I do.
In the Northeast, outside. This record, hottest ever recorded July. So it's not that we just get one or two of these, but we keep seeing these. And as Heidi mentions, this tells you that it is a changing climate right now. We're forcing the climate into a new state, a different state. The scary part to me is we've just really started to see these effects, and they're going to keep going for quite some time.
What I hear you both saying, Heidi, is we're looking at this trend, and trends, I guess, tell us something about where the weather is going.
That's right. I think when you look at the evolution of climate science, at first we looked at large spatial averages over long periods of time, and that's where it was clear that we were seeing things that looked out of the norm, right? And as our models got better, as our data sets got longer, we were able to zoom in higher resolution, time and space. And what we're seeing now is that climate change is not just this large global average. It is also expressed in the extremes. And so when you warm up the atmosphere, you can expect to see more extremes, things like intense droughts, heat waves that last longer, are more frequent, and are more intense. And also, we've seen a clear shift in the observational data record of rainfall towards more heavy rainfall events. So as the science has gotten better, our understanding of the way extremes will change has gotten better.
Let me turn back to you, David Titley. You have a great way for us to think about climate and even climate change, which is to think of it as an orchestra. Can you spell that out for us?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember exactly which
one. Oh, I scribbled it down here.
That
but there are all these components.
I use these. I never remember the analogy. So let me give you another
one. I'm here
to
remind
you.
No, go ahead.
Here, if I could give you another one. So I'll bet many of your listeners go to the Jersey Shore in the summertime, and at least for a week or two. And we've all probably built sandcastles along the beach, and we've all seen them taken out. So if you think of it in a very simple analogy, the climate is that rising tide that comes up. But what takes out our sandcastle? It's that wave, right? So you can sort of think of the weather on top of the climate. And they're, you know, not to torture this analogy too much, but, you know, that first wave could be kind of like that extreme event that Heidi was talking about. But if you come back for the tidal case, you know, a few minutes later, a lot of waves are now reaching where that extreme did. And if you come back later still, you'll see it's underwater. And now it would almost take an unusually good day to get as cool as what we are now thinking in 2016 to be very, very hot. Now, of course, the tide goes back out. Unfortunately for the climate, we're heading in one direction, and that is up. But you can kind of think of these weather and extreme weather events as the harbinger of what will become normal in a matter of decades.
Well, I wonder, too, picking up on that, going back to you, Heidi Cullen, which is sea level rise that is measurable. It's visible. It has a more constant presence to it. Is that something that you think could convince some of the skeptics that there is indeed global warming, climate change?
Yeah, I think sea level rise has probably also already changed the minds of a couple of folks, because I think people can really see the difference. And, you know, the projections that we give on the high end, upwards of 6 to 7 feet by the end of the century, again, that's looking out towards the end of the century. But what we're seeing right now is the increased likelihood of coastal storm surge events, right? So if you buy a 30-year mortgage, if you live on the coast, you know that with global warming, with the 8 inches of sea level rise that we've already seen, your chances of getting flooded are going to increase. And you know, just about anybody who lives along the coastal Florida zone will tell you that they see it happening already. Miami is definitely ground zero.
Do you think the insurance companies will do what some politicians are reluctant to do?
That is the million-dollar question. What is going to happen with insurance? Because I think we're seeing increasingly, as the risks become more severe, the question is, will insurance become unavailable to some folks? And it is already in some places.
Let me turn to you, back to you, David Titley. As I mentioned, you're a retired rear admiral, led the U.S. Navy's Task Force on Climate Change. President Obama said at a State of the Union address, the Pentagon says that climate change poses immediate risk to our national security and we should act like it. How is the Pentagon addressing the potential threats of climate change?
So the Pentagon is looking at this in a variety of different ways, and I'll just try to kind of boil it all down there. There are both direct and indirect effects of climate change. So we've just talked about the sea level rise, and I come from the U.S. Navy. So
right.
When I would talk about climate change, I said one of the things we're going to have to watch out for is where are our bases. I mean, you know, by definition, a Navy base is at sea level. We're not like the Air Force. We can't just all move to North Dakota, Minot, and not worry about it too much. So the bases in the United States way of war, the way we want to operate our military, is we play what I call the away game. We send our forces overseas to go do the mission of our national command authorities. But we generate those forces that are, frankly, the world's best. that happens at the bases. And if the bases are under stress, either through sea level rise, through extreme temperatures, you can't do the training, through the both direct and impacts of fires, wildfires, that directly impacts the United States military. There are indirect effects, and we can talk about them later if you would like to, such as the impacts of climate change on already unstable regions in the world. And then finally, the Arctic is opening up. The Arctic is changing faster than literally any place else in the world right now, and that will have profound geopolitical implications.
Let me pick up on the second one, the effect of things like drought on the Middle East and the politics that we are observing in the Middle East. Can we at least point some of the arrows, David Titley, to climate change?
Yeah, so I probably have an answer that makes all sides unhappy with me. The left has certainly said that it is a very simple and direct connection, that that the mess and ISIL in Syria has been caused by climate change. The right denies that there is any such connection. I think the actual answer is somewhere in between, that when you start looking at the origins of some of the instabilities and the rise of these radical extremist groups, there are a lot of different causes. And it's kind of like a chain of event. Anybody who's ever read or looked at an airliner investigation, a crash investigation, you'll see that there are many different components that all come together to cause a catastrophic event. And I would say the Middle East right now is a catastrophic event.
Right.
One of those links can be the unprecedented droughts that we have seen out in the eastern Mediterranean. But it's combined with very poor governance. It's combined with Assad not taking care of his people. It's combined with one of the outfalls of the Iraq War of 2003, where you had 1 million refugees coming into Syria. It's combined with Assad's policies on water. He wanted to be self-sufficient in food and basically drained his aquifers and his rivers. But then when you put on top of that the climate-induced drought and heat, there was no reserve. There was no plan B. And literally the region fell into chaos. So it is one of the causes. It's not the only cause, but it is certainly a significant contributing factor to what we face today in the Middle East.
We're almost up on a break here, but to you, Heidi, are there lessons from what David just said?
Well, you know, to build on Dave's point, you know, the military will call this a threat multiplier, right? And I'll just say, to step back, when I was in graduate school, I looked at the collapse of the world's first civilization, the Akkadian Empire, 4,200 years ago. And the goal of my research was to actually look at the role that climate played. And in this case, natural climate variability. And what we found was, again, the tendency towards drought definitely makes civilizations more fragile, more vulnerable. And so it's really just to say, look, we are vulnerable to changes in climate, and we need to remember that at all times.
Well, that's Heidi Cullen. She's chief scientist at Climate Central. Also with us, David Titley, professor of meteorology at Penn State University, the founding director of their Center for Solutions to Weather and Climate Risk. We're going to take a very short break, much more to talk about, including the floods in Louisiana, looking to connect some of the dots between some of these extreme weather events and climate change. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and we are exploring the possible link between heat waves and droughts and floods and big storms and the warming planet, again with our guests Heidi Cullen and David Titley. Let me talk to you, Heidi. And David, I want to make sure you're part of this conversation as well. As we know, these torrential rains in Louisiana, I think, you know, 20 to 30 inches of rain over the course of 20 to 48 hours. What are you, Heidi, looking for and trying to understand? Is this the result of some kind of climate change?
Yeah, you know, so I think that when an extreme weather event happens right now, there's always a lot of questions that get asked in the immediate aftermath. And climate change is one of the questions that people want an answer to. And I think it is actually really important to have that conversation, because as we know, climate change, the warming of our atmosphere, it does make the likelihood of certain kinds of extremes more likely to happen. And so the team that we've assembled, World Weather Attribution, we're actually looking at the Louisiana heavy rainfall event right now. And so what we really do is we use climate models and observational data to essentially perform an autopsy on that event and answer the question, not did climate change cause the event, but to answer the question, did climate change play a role, and to what extent did climate change make this event more likely or more intense?
I wonder, too, whether the way we have built our environment, whether that exacerbates, you know, a rain level of that magnitude.
Absolutely. We cannot ignore the question of infrastructure. And that's why, you know, a week out from Louisiana, I think it's so important to continue this conversation, because I think a lot of attention is focused on the actual disaster. And then the conversation ends and we don't ask the hard questions about infrastructure and how we build back smarter.
Well, to you, David Titley, is certainly the Pentagon has to think, or the military has to think about things like infrastructure. Have we created an environment that makes some of these extreme events even more destructive?
Well, I think that's an easy question. I mean, as we build, and we tend to build to whether it's military or civilian, we almost always tend to build to, you know, meet whatever that immediate need was, and we don't necessarily think about how that will look, let's say, in the context of these extreme events. So, you know, if you're a good engineer, what you normally do is you'll go take like the last 100 years of records, whether it's heat or rainfall, snow, and says, well, I'll add a margin of safety and off we go. And unfortunately, with climate change, is the past is no longer that guide to the future anymore. Mm. So, you know, whether it's Louisiana, whether it's Maryland, whether it's, you know, pick the next place, we see what we think are unprecedented rains, and then the infrastructure, you know, simply can't handle it. So we're going to have to, you know, we can pay now or we can pay later. We can either put some money in designing to structures that people might say, well, geez, you know, we've never seen such and such a rainfall. Or we can pay FEMA and through insurance to try to pick up the pieces when we see that we either have an event that exceeded the historical expectations. So it's a civilian and a military problem. It's really everybody's problem who deals with infrastructure.
But how do we reverse a warming planet? I'm looking at you, Heidi.
Well,
I mean, it seems like things are already kind of baked into our climate.
There's a certain amount that is already baked in, right? And that's the challenge of climate change, right? That by the time you really, really see the impacts, it's too late. And so I think what we're talking about right now is the fact
is
that
it's too late now?
No,
okay.
No, there is actually so much good news to talk about, right? The conversation that took place in Paris was very transformative. We're in a position right now where over 190 countries have said that they will act to reduce emissions. And so this is very much a solvable problem. But we have to see the urgency. That's why the science is so important. You cannot solve a problem you can't see. So as scientists, we need to help people see how bad it is, how urgent it is, and really help folks understand that these forecasts, when we talk about the future, when we talk about changing risks, it's to say that we have choices and that we can prevent the worst outcome with immediate action.
Do you share her optimism, David?
I wish I did. I'm not pessimistic, but we have a saying in the Navy: potential is interesting, but performance counts. So yes, Paris was very good, especially some of the aspirational goals there. But we need to see actual conversion. So we talk a lot, let's say, about renewable energy in this country, but what wind is 4 to 5%, solar is about 1%. We need to see those numbers not only in the U.S., but worldwide, you know, get out of the niche markets, and really non-carbon has to become predominant. So our question is, you know, I think that will happen, but it has to happen quickly. It can't happen over a couple of centuries, because that really does mean we're going to see huge, huge impacts in climate. So I'm maybe a little bit more cautious on the optimism than Heidi, but I do agree that action now will prevent the worst of the consequences for the future. But the question is are we going to be smart enough in human civilization not to wait for the calamity to happen? And I think that is an open question. I sure hope we do, but it's not a given.
Heidi, who's the largest carbon emitter in the world?
Right now, China is the largest emitter. The U.S. is the largest historical emitter. And, you know, India is coming online as well. And so I think, you know, Dave is a very wise man. And so we need to be pragmatic, but we need to really behave as if this is an urgent threat, because it truly is. And, you know, I think one way to look at it is that we actually need to transform our energy economy by 2050. We have to no longer be a fossil fuel economy by 2050. So if we want to frame the problem, that's kind of where it's at.
You had a piece in the New York Times, Think It's Hot Now, Just Wait. That was the headline. And you predicted, or looking at the fact that temperatures have been increasing, looking at New York City from 91 to 2010, 2 days over 95. You predict by 2060 there will be 15 days over 95, and by 2100, 42 days, which could be almost an entire summer of temperatures over 95. When you predict something like this, are you saying that if we don't do something, this is our future? I'm holding this piece of paper on the radio here.
That's right. I mean, it's really meant to be a visualization exercise and to really, I think, focus on the fact that we have choices. One of my favorite quotes is by Sherry Rowland, Nobel Prize winning chemist who helped discover the ozone hole. And what Sherry said is, what's the point of having developed a science well enough to make predictions if all we do is sit around and wait for them to come true? And so those projections are really meant to say, look, this is what happens if we do nothing.
Well, in fact, in looking at Dallas, you predict by the year 2100, 133 days. That's almost a third of the year over 95.
And that is
why to scare us?
That is why we need to act now, right? Because the climate system works in these slow ways, and once it's in the pipeline, it's very, very hard to get out. And that's why the sooner we act, the easier and the cheaper it is to solve in the long run.
David, here's a first grade question for you. Why does climate change or a warming planet create both floods and droughts?
So it's a good question, and it's one that a lot of people ask, and smart people ask. So here's kind of what happens is, as you warm up the planet, basically the atmosphere can hold, and all my fellow meteorology professors will cringe when I use that term, but I think your listeners know what I mean. Can hold more water vapor, and so when it rains, it has the potential to rain harder and more intense. And we're seeing, Heidi mentioned this, and we've seen this time and time and time again. It's not just once in a place. But when it stops raining, it's hotter. And we all know that if you want to really dry something out, do you put it in a place that's cold or a place that's hot? You put it where it's hot. And also, it turns out that drought begets drought, if you will. When you start getting a weather pattern that is hot and dry, that tends to perpetuate itself until you get a major change in the atmosphere. So you can, in fact, have this paradox, but when you kind of think about it, it unfortunately makes sense. Is when it rains, you can have much more intense rainfall, and then you get all the issues with flooding, with erosion, with loss of life, loss of infrastructure. But in between that, when it stops raining, you dry things out, and then you set the stage either for agricultural drought or some of the horrific fires that we've been seeing. And this is unfortunately, you know, what we are going to experience here for at least the next few decades, and it will be more so if we don't get to the root cause and transform our energy system to non-carbon-based ways of powering ourselves.
That's David Titley. He's a professor of meteorology at Penn State University, the founding director of their Center for Solutions to Weather and Climate Risk. I should add, he's a retired Rear Admiral, and he led the U.S. Navy's Task Force on Climate Change. Heidi Cullen with us as well. She's chief scientist at Climate Central. She leads the World Weather Attribution Program. She also serves as the chief science advisor for the Years of Living Dangerously Project, wrote a book called The Weather of the Future. And that's what we're talking about in this hour of Radio Times. And again, you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. A lot of comments here, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Here's a tweet from John. Says, what are the best examples of unambiguous evidence for our warming planet? Heidi, can you take that?
You know, I'll say that one analysis that I found incredibly powerful was from the Great Barrier Reef this summer. Some colleagues of mine from the University of Melbourne actually looked at the coral bleaching event in the northern section of the Great Barrier Reef, which is the most pristine section of the reef. And what they found was the warming of the sea surface temperatures in the Coral Sea essentially exacerbated that event. And they made – and so to answer this question, what role did climate change play? They found that climate change made that coral bleaching event 175 times more likely.
Wow.
Okay. And so when you get to a number that high, you're now in the zone where that event would have been virtually impossible without climate change, right? So when I see something like that, that to me is a smoking gun.
Is it because the water's warmer, or is it the acidification, or a combination of the two?
It is because the waters were so much warmer in the Coral Sea.
Ah, let me get David from looks like Flemington to join our conversation. And David, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
One of the things that keeps occurring to me in this heat is that residential building doesn't make any sense. The few buildings I see that are kind of half underground, those make sense because it's cooler the farther into the earth you go. So it seems like if all the predictions are true, residential building where it doesn't flood, and out of the cities, of course, would have to go more into the ground where it's cooler and not high up where you're under this hot sun with all of these shingles that heat up to hundreds of degrees. And then on the floodplains, it would have to go higher. I just wondered what your callers thought.
David, thanks for the call. David Titley, let me toss that to you. Should we burrow down like our little, you know, underground creatures?
Sure. I mean, if you go, actually, since we were talking about Australia, if you go to the outback, you'll see quite a few houses are already built that way where they do have these extreme temperatures. I think your listener, though, brings up some good points, is that adaptation is there are multiple ways, and we'll probably have to use multiple ways to adapt to the piece of the climate that is already, as you mentioned, baked in and that will come for decades to come. So smart building, whether that is underground, whether that is accounting for storm surges and floods that we have not previously seen, efficiencies in many ways, how do we maximize the non-carbon-based power production for whether it's microgrids or individual houses even. But all of that together is going to be absolutely critical so that as the climate changes, we can minimize the impact to our livelihoods, to our personal safety, to our economy. And if you think about it, that's a really a tremendous number of new and growth industries that will spawn to account for that. So while we've been talking about some pretty serious things, to fix this is actually some real opportunities here for the next generation, since my generation kind of screwed this up for everybody.
I don't know what generation you are, David, but I appreciate you taking entire responsibility for what we've been talking about.
I'm old.
You're old. Okay, fair enough. Heidi, I did post something on our Facebook page. It was in the New York Times, actually, this morning about this little village in England where they just basically decided we're going to address this problem of climate change on a small scale. We're going to do it individually. We don't want politicians to get involved. We're going to take this on ourselves. And it looks like looks like a fascinating description. And I posted that and I asked that because I think sometimes out of discussions like this, there is this fear that you know, it's just hopeless that there's nothing we can do. I know you're the resident optimist here, but just I don't want to give people pie in the sky solutions, but this sense that we can do something.
Yeah. You know, I think if we've learned anything over the past 10 years of talking about climate change, it's to recognize that if, and as a scientist, it's part of my job, right, to talk about the risks, but if we only talk about the risks, we lose the opportunity to talk about the fact that this is solvable. You know, Dave just pointed out all of the things that we need to be thinking about. And I think that the story in the Times was really wonderful because what it shows us is that, okay, climate change in many ways, I think it's the perfect threat, right? It's hard to see. It eludes our classic senses, right? It requires sort of this rational thinking. But when you actually can see it and when you can admit that this is truly urgent, it presents so many different opportunities to us. And I think it shows us that we need to address the problem at the federal level, at the international level, like we saw in Paris, but also at the local level. And cities are really at the forefront of climate change. And what you're seeing happen in cities around the country is people really taking action and communities coming together and saying, look, we're going to do this. We're going to make something happen.
I wonder, David, if climate change looked like smog, and by that I mean you could taste it and smell it and see it, whether there would be a greater sense of urgency.
It's funny you mentioned that. I was thinking that exact same thought driving to the studio here. As you know, in the Northeast, we've have some really nice weather here at Penn State. It's actually in the 50s, and you can see forever. And I was thinking, you know, if you could see the carbon dioxide and you would just never have like nice blue sky days, if that would help change things. But the reality is that's not where we're there. So visualizations such as done by Climate Central and by many others are going to be part of what we can try our best to get people to understand that this is an issue where we're going to have to take action. And if we don't take action, we will suffer. There's a saying in the submarine force that the stupid shall be punished. And I would plead to everybody, let's not be stupid here.
Indeed. We're almost up in a break, Heidi, but I know you want to say something.
Well, you know, to build on what Dave said, I think what we're seeing is in China, the pollution is so bad that is one of the reasons why China has decided to take climate change seriously. So, you know, there's some aspects of burning fossil fuels that have a really big and visible impact.
Well, we need the Cuyahoga River to catch on fire here, or the equivalent.
Well, and David, I'm old like you, and I remember living in Philadelphia in 1970, that summer. You could hardly see the blue sky. David Titley and Heidi Cullen are guests in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about extreme weather events, and questions of climate change and what to do about it. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with David Titley, professor of meteorology at Penn State University, also the founding director of their Center for Solutions to Weather and Climate Risk, and with Heidi Cullen, chief scientist at Climate Central, and leads the World Weather Attribution Program. And again, we are talking about some of these extreme weather events that have been taking place around the world, and the connection to climate change and what to do about it. Let me get, looks like, Gary. We'll take Gary. I'm just watching my computer change here. We've got Gary from, looks like Bally, Pennsylvania. Gary, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you. Good morning.
Morning.
I was curious as to your guest's opinion as to whether there's any causal relationship between the seemingly low temperature that we're seeing in the ocean water off New Jersey and the average temperatures.
The low temperature. I was just actually swimming in the New Jersey ocean, and it was, I have to say, it was quite warm and delightful. I'm looking at you, Heidi. You are an oceanographer. I assume there's some variability.
Yeah. In fact, you can pull up a global map of sea surface temperatures. You'll see, you know, there's spots that are cold, spots that are warm. In fact, there was a fairly warm spot of sea surface temperatures off the Gulf, which many meteorologists felt contributed to making the flooding event worse in the Gulf Coast recently. But really, maybe the larger point to make is that we are seeing a human contribution to ocean surface warming. So we know that global warming is not just in play on land, but also over the oceans.
Let me turn to you, David. You mentioned the Arctic, and we know that the Arctic is opening up essentially because of climate change. What I guess foreign policy issues you think are related to that?
So there's a whole raft of issues that come with this, and you can really look at, I guess, the way to kind of summarize it all is the Arctic becomes and really enters sort of the mainstream part of the world. And that's not to say there are millions of people who live in the Arctic, and it's not to say that they haven't been. But as the Arctic changes, you're going to see that region further integrated into the world's economy. You will see at least seasonally, and this won't be today or tomorrow, but in decades to come, you will see the shipping routes start to take more advantage of the Arctic, especially as what we call the multi-year, the really thick hard ice, all but disappears from the significant shipping routes. I think if it hasn't started, it's about to start. Serenity Cruise Lines is running one of their really big ships that takes, you know, thousands of passengers, and they're running it basically from Alaska through the Northwest Passage down to the east coast of the United States. There's a lot of issues
there
for
are.
That. It'll be a spectacular cruise, but there's very little search and rescue capability. The charts are still sketchy. People want to see the things that are frankly dangerous from a navigation standpoint, like ice and rocks, and that because that's where the wildlife lives. So we see all of that. What will probably not happen in the Arctic is sort of this Wild West race for resources, because almost all the resources are known where they are. But what you will see is significantly increased human activity both ashore and in the ocean. And with activity, unless it's regulated, unless it's governed, comes both the possibility for environmental disasters, but also, unless it's regulated, comes the possibility for conflict.
Yes. Let me read a tweet from Iris. Says, Marty, you perpetuate climate change denial by saying possible link. Humans are responsible for most of climate change. Scientific research indicates climate change will cause hurricane storms to become more intense. What do you say to that, Heidi Cullen?
I would agree. I think that right now, hurricanes, these small-scale storms are obviously – they're hard. They're hard to untangle because they happen for a variety of very special reasons. Things like tornadoes, hurricanes are special. But in terms of where the science is at right now on hurricanes, our best understanding suggests that we will see a shift towards more intense hurricanes in the Atlantic Basin. We may see a fewer number overall, but those that we see moving forward in time could be more intense, more Cat 3s, 4s, and 5s.
So should I not say possible link? I'm not a scientist, and I'm trying to be correct. Knowing that this science is evolving, you're looking for cause and effect.
Well, you know, it's funny because I think this whole issue of, you know, when is it climate change, when isn't it, it becomes as if every question is a referendum on climate change, especially when we talk about individual extreme events. And I think it's really important to acknowledge that our weather and our climate system is fundamentally different because of our decision over 150 years ago to begin burning fossil fuels. And so our climate has changed. Climate change is real. We know that the majority of the warming that we've seen is human-caused. So there is no referendum on the issue. But I, as a scientist, I appreciate your care in talking about individual events because it's complex.
David, you want to weigh in on this as well?
Yeah, I mean
language
Heidi
matters.
It,
I'm trying, you know, and I appreciate
exactly,
the tweet as well.
Exactly right. That the fundamentals of climate are very well known. When I talk about this, I tell people this is cutting edge 19th century science that we're talking about as far as understanding the basics. It goes back to basically 1842, give or take, right. And we've confirmed and reconfirmed and re-reconfirmed that. Now, there are, of course, still details when you get down to regional levels and decadal timescales, you know, timescales of, let's say, 5, 6, 7, 10 years, things like that. Very interesting. How fast is the sea going to come up? Those are cutting-edge questions. But the basics we understand. We understand why it's hotter. We understand why it rains harder. We're starting to understand that, as Heidi mentioned, not only in the Atlantic but likely in other basins, if the waters, the ocean waters, warm up. Your hurricanes have the potential, and to get stronger. That doesn't mean all of them will, but the potential is there. So it's like, you know, if you could think of, let's say, a Katrina or a Camille as, let's say, 100 sticks of dynamite, well, now maybe you have 130 sticks of dynamite. So that's the kind of thing that is changing, and the science is there's simply no doubt about that. It's kind of like arguing about gravity.
Let me see what Chris from Frankfurt has to say. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Welcome back to the Arctic. I had read several years ago now in a book that I don't remember the author, 6 Degrees, which concluded with one possible scenario, which actually seems to be a greater possibility with every year, passing era, of because of global warming and the warming of the ocean, the possible release of massive amounts of, methane hydrates from the ocean floor around Siberia and the Arctic and so forth, which is been under the ocean floor in a frozen form, but is becoming released. It's actually releasing through the warming of the oceans. And this, from what I've read and seen it elsewhere, it could be a massive game changer. Methane is a far, far more potent toxin than CO2.
You know, Chris, let me put that to our oceanographer here,
yeah.
Heidi Cullen.
I mean, Chris, I think it's a really important point because I think, you know, as we've been saying, it's really important that we all treat climate change as this incredibly urgent issue, in part because of, you know, what some folks would call the monsters behind the door, those aspects of our climate system that we don't fully know when the tipping point will be reached. I think, you know, Arctic permafrost thaw and the release of methane from the permafrost, the situation that you describe, and even the feedback of wildfires, right? That the more wildfires you have, the greater likelihood of increased and larger wildfires, right? These feedback processes. And so this question of tipping points is the kind of question that we're better off not being forced to deal with, which is why we need to act sooner rather than later.
David, what do you think about geoengineering, carbon capture? I mean, there are all these possible, I'm using that word again, possible ways of dealing with what we've been talking about. Do you see some potential benefits?
So there was, if you really want to get people stirred up, just start talking about geoengineering. Which
we've done a couple of those shows, and I can attest to that. Go ahead.
Yes, it just basically, in case somebody isn't quite sure what that term means, but you can think of the large-scale intentional modification by man to change the climate to undo the unintentional modification. And I usually say, what could possibly go wrong with that? So there are two parts of what we and the National Academy, we did a report I was privileged to be a part of. We called it climate intervention because we thought the term engineering, frankly, implied too much skill and too much ability to control what we were doing. But the two parts are basically, can you remove carbon dioxide, the main major greenhouse gas, or do you actually reduce the amount of sunlight coming to the atmosphere? And there's sort of two sides of the coin. And very quickly, the carbon dioxide removal, it is not very risky, but the issues are cost and scale. And you come up to some very fundamental laws of physics that potentially just sucking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere gets quite hard. But it is certainly a place for research. The flip side of that is changing the amount of sunlight getting to the ocean. And many people think of, you know, basically simulating a volcano, spraying little tiny aerosols, little tiny particles way up in the atmosphere, like 60, 70,000 feet. We're pretty sure, in fact, we're very sure that would, in fact, reduce the amount of heat. But we're also quite sure it would have other unintended changes, primarily to major precipitation regions, major rainfall regions that are frankly not really predictable. So that we see, although you could do this and probably do this at some sort of cost, the risks are very, very high. So the Academy's conclusion on this is that there really is no silver bullet. There's no magic technical solution to get us out of where we are other than moving ourselves to non-carbon-based energy systems and doing that as rapidly as we can. There's no quick fix to this issue.
David mentioned volcano, you know, sort of volcano-like eruptions, and I do remember some really big volcano eruptions did, Heidi, kind of cool the planet for a while.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's how we got the idea. So sulfate aerosols have a tendency to cool the atmosphere. And in fact, we used volcanic eruptions as a way to test our climate models to predict the amount of cooling. And, you know, Dave answered the question so well. I'll say geoengineering, it kind of scares, you know, most aspects of geoengineering scare the bejesus out of me. Carbon capture and storage, I think, will be an important conversation to have. I mean, right. as India comes online with more coal-fired power plants, they've also got a strong play in solar. They want to become a solar powerhouse. But we are going to, if we take the Paris 1.5 degrees Celsius target seriously, the conversation about negative emissions is one that we're going to have. So I don't think it's going to go away.
And David, as we know, this is often framed, you know, the environment versus jobs. That certainly came up during the primary in coal country in Hillary Clinton and also Donald Trump and some of the other candidates talking about the future of that industry. And certainly it has meant jobs, but at the same time, there are these environmental consequences. Do you have a way in on this challenge?
Well, it is a challenge, and I think that we have to be cognizant of the displacement that is going to happen in fossil fuel industries. I mean, ultimately, the fossil fuel industry long term will be much less a part of the economy, and I'm sure that'll probably upset some people by me saying that, but that's going to happen long term. I think it becomes easier to do socially if there is, in fact, real off-ramps and real training opportunities and real ways to take care of those people. Because that coal miner, that person working in an oil field, I mean, he or she, they're trying to make the monthly payment on their truck, and they're trying to pay the mortgage, put food on their table, and they can, you know, quite easily feel like, you know, why is the world against me? And I don't think the world is against them, but we need to, for the sake of everybody, we need to change. But having off ramps, solar conversion, wind, I mean, these are actually generating a fair amount of jobs. We talked about adaptation, new different ways of building. So how do we make sure that people aren't out of work as much as there are opportunities to do different things so that we have as good or better a life in a non-carbon-based energy world than we do right now. And I think that's a message. This is not a zero sum. This is positive sum, but it is going to require change. And change is tough. We know that for everybody.
Almost out of time here, Heidi. What then can an individual person do?
Well, I think it really highlights the fact that the choices we make in terms of elected officials is going to be really important, because we need leadership that's willing to recognize that these are the kinds of issues we need to work on. We need to think about jobs. We need to think about how we are going to build more resilient communities. We need to talk about infrastructure. So, you know, that one fundamental point of who we elect to help have these conversations is really critical.
Well, I have really enjoyed this conversation. My thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Heidi Cullen, thanks so much. Thanks for coming in and joining us here in our Philadelphia studio.
Thank you, Marty.
She's chief scientist at Climate Central, leads the World Weather Attribution Program, wrote a book called The Weather of the Future, also serves as the chief science advisor for the Years of Living Dangerously Project. David Titley, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Yeah, thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Professor of Meteorology at Penn State University, founding director of their Center for Solutions to Weather and Climate Risk, also a retired Rear Admiral. He led the U.S. Navy's Task Force on Climate Change. We appreciate all the calls and the comments to Radio Times. Certainly carry on this conversation. You can do that on our Facebook page. I'm Marty Moscowing. Thanks for joining us. Stay with us.